Well, we continue this morning in the season of Lent, this season where our eyes are focused in on that old rugged cross. As the song says, that emblem of suffering and shame. I've heard a lot of sermons about the suffering part, not so many about the shame. I think that if we don't understand what the cross has to say to shame and the shame that we ourselves carry around inside of us, then we haven't seen the whole picture of the cross. We're really good at talking about the cross and what it has to say to guilt, but maybe not so much shame. So last week I invited you on this journey that maybe in this season of Lent we could see a bigger picture of the cross and in fact hear more good news about the cross, more gospel news for our own lives. We began by looking at the two sides of that human moral impulse we have, the feelings that arise within us whenever we commit an error, whenever we do something wrong, whenever we sin. They're like two sides of the same coin, though they are very different. One is guilt. It's what we feel when we know that we have done something wrong. The other is shame. Guilt always looks to the action. It says, I'm sorry, I did something wrong or I made a mistake. But shame always looks to the person. Shame says, I'm sorry, I am wrong. I am the mistake. They're very different this way. There's a very simple solution for guilt. You just punish it. Because once the debt created by the error has been satisfied, guilt goes away. The problem with shame is you can't punish shame away. Shame is this overwhelming sense that I'm not actually worthy or deserving of love and connection and belonging. Shame is the voice inside of us that says, I'm not good enough, I'm not thin enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not fill in the blank for your own life. Every time we hear that, that is the voice of shame. So guilt and shame are very different. Understanding this and understanding what the cross has to say to shame, I think, is becoming more and more relevant given the cultural moment we live in. What the studies seem to be suggesting is that as a culture, all of us collectively are moving more and more towards a narcissistic personality type. What that indicates is that as individuals, we're scoring higher and higher scores on different narcissistic traits. And what we know about narcissism, a couple things. First, it arises out of a deep experience of shame. Underneath narcissism is the overwhelming sense that I am not worthy, that I'm unacceptable. And the problem with a narcissist is that they don't really experience guilt. Overwhelming shame, but they don't think that they've actually done anything wrong. That's the sort of people we're meeting these days. You talk to them and you try and talk about sin and it just doesn't connect. It doesn't resonate because they think, well, I've not really done anything wrong. And yet when I'm honest, deep down inside, I feel really, really awful about myself. You can understand why a gospel that has talked about the cross primarily in terms of guilt as substitutionary atonement no longer resonates with the people we're trying to share the gospel with. We come up to them and say, hey, I've got good news for your guilt. What guilt? I've got shame. What does your gospel have to say with shame? And this isn't just outside the church, it's inside the church. There are loads of Christians who'd say, you know my sins are forgiven, and yet I still feel really awful inside. Does the cross speak to that? There you go. That was my sermon last week in about 4 minutes. Some of you are wondering, why can't he preach 4 minutes every week? Because then you'd miss the illustrations, and that's the best stuff, right? We all deal with shame. On some level, all of us deal with it. Usually when I talk about shame, women get it right away. They're like, yes, I know what you're talking about. Men, we're a little bit slower. Often for men, shame lives underneath something else, usually anger. But it's there. We all deal with shame. Shame can wreak havoc in our lives. But if the cross really is good news, if the gospel is a word of good news to every culture, in all times, every generation, including our own cultural moment, I think it has to say something to the shame that you and I are carrying around. But before we go after that, before we really look intently on what the cross has to say about it, I want to ask another question. Maybe one, if you were listening last week, that would surprise you. Is shame always bad? Is shame always bad? I mean, if you heard my message last week, you're like, yeah, it's got to be. Pastor said nothing good about shame. It's always bad. Is it always bad? Or maybe ask the question just a little bit different. If shame says that there's something wrong with me, not just that I've done wrong, but that I am wrong, is that not exactly what the church has always said in its doctrine of original sin? Yes, it is. Original sin. The doctrine of original sin tells us that you and I were created in the image of God. That's what Genesis tells us. The problem that sin brings into the world is that it broke that image. It marred it. It distorted it. Adam and Eve had the perfect image of God, but after sin, the image of God in them was broken and tarnished and marred. And understand, that is how you and I entered into this life. We came into life. We had the image, but the image itself was broken. And we live out of that brokenness. We perpetuate that brokenness in all sorts of things, like our attitudes, our actions, our behavior, our relationships. That's where sin comes from. It comes from the fact that the image of God in us, it's a broken thing, fundamentally. It is in need of repair. So no, I don't think we can say that shame is always a bad thing if shame seems to agree with the doctrine of original sin. Well, what then do we do with that? What I want to suggest to you this morning is that part of us growing up emotionally is going to be able to discern the difference between healthy shame and unhealthy shame. The question we have to answer is, how in the world do we know the difference? I had intended this morning to bring a book up here with me. I think I forgot it in my office. You can imagine I'm holding it. It's a book by a guy named Lewis Smedes, and the book is called Shame and Grace, Healing the Shame That You Do Not Deserve. I've read a lot of books as I've been preparing for this series, as I've been trying to wrap my mind around what shame has to do with the cross. I wouldn't recommend any of them to you except for this one. It is an excellent book. I looked online Friday. You can pick it up, shipped $7 used. You can get the paperback brand new for $12.63 on Amazon Prime. I promise you it will be the best $12 you spend this year. If anything I've said today or last week or during the series resonates with you, if you're thinking, you know, maybe I've got an issue with shame, get yourself the book. If it's not the best $12 you've spent, I'll give you the $12. I believe in it that much. It's a very easy read. Now, I mentioned the book because I'm going to borrow some of his categories as we try and understand how do I differentiate between healthy and unhealthy shame. Shame is always an assessment of the self. Shame's always about self-evaluation. Smead says we can talk about the self really in three ways. There is the true self, there is the false self, and then there is the actual self. The actual self is just me, as I am right now in this moment. The actual self is the me in my head that makes decisions and has hopes and dreams and thoughts. It's the subconscious me. From where impulses and instincts arise. It's me in relationship with you and in conversation. It's me on the stage. It's me in the coffee shop. It's just the self as I actually am in this present moment. That's pretty straightforward. And then there's the true self. The true self, Smead says, is the self that God created me to be. It is me in the very best moments of my life. It's the me that loves others wholeheartedly, without reservation, that loves sacrificially. It is the me that lives out of a place of gratitude. It's the me that recognizes that all of life, every breath is a gift. Even the snow and the rain that we gripe about, all of it is a gift from God, and I live from a place of gratitude and thanksgiving. It's the me that is both humble and courageous. I accept myself as I am. I am at peace with my limitations, and yet I also recognize that I have God-given gifts and talents that I have a responsibility to steward, not just for me, but for those around me. I am courageous, and I face difficulty and hardship and suffering with hope. Oh, with hope and with faith. It's the me that is constantly leaning on God's grace. Because, man, that's the only way to live. But it's also the me that's always extending grace to everybody else. It is the true self that God intended for me to be. And healthy shame rises out of the discrepancy between my actual self as I am today and the true self God intended me to be. Because the truth is, I don't always live up to who God made me to be and what He made me to be. Too often I hurt others, and I don't act in love, and I act selfishly. And in those moments, I hear a true voice from my true self calling out to me, saying, "Hey, you know what? You're better than that. You were made for more." Healthy shame is a good voice calling us back to what God intended us to be from the very, very beginning. What is that? Well, it's an image bearer. Remember? You and I were made in the image of God. And this is something we kind of toss around in church sometimes, but I'm not sure we're always very clear on what it means. We talk about, oh, you bear the image of God, you bear the image. Well, what in the world does that mean? So often it seems like it gets watered down. And in the past, the church has simply meant that it was the difference between me and the animals, you know, that I have a soul or I have rationality. In most churches today, I think it gets watered down to mean, well, your life has significance. That's all true, but if that's all that it means, I don't know if it tells me anything about ontology, what I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to do with this life that I have, the issue of vocation. And so I like how N.T. Wright talks about it. He tells a story from his childhood. When he was a small boy, he became very, very ill. And his mother put him in a room by himself, kind of quarantined. And as he was in this room, he got very lonely. He felt very cut off from the rest of the house. And so his mother brought in a mirror, and she set it at an angle at the very end of the bed so he could look into the mirror, and then he could see down the hall and out the door. And he could see the family coming and going, and he could see them, and they could see him. And all of a sudden, he felt more connected and involved, even though he was still isolated with what was going on in the house. And so Wright tells us that's not a bad picture for what God intended at the beginning of all things when He made man and woman in His image. It's as if God created everything, but He had no plans to micromanage it. And so He put somebody who was like Him, who would, like a mirror, reflect Him into all of His created order. So humanity stands like a mirror between God and all of creation, and our job is to reflect Him out. His love, His care, His compassion, yes, even His dominion and the ruling of creation. And then when all of creation looks to the image bearer, what they actually see is the Creator. That's what God made us to be. And this idea picks up different imagery as we move through Scripture in the Old Testament. It's the imagery of a royal priesthood. What does the priest do? The priest stands in between the people and God. They're listening with one ear to what God has to say, and they repeat it to the people. But then they gather up the worship of the people, the sacrifices and the offerings, and they bring and present it to God. And Wright says, this is an interesting idea that Paul kind of picks up on. He says, what if we were to gather all of the worship of all of creation, and our job is then to bring that to God? Would that change how we sang on Sunday mornings? That's a different sermon, but do you see what I'm saying? That's my true self. An image that reflects God to the world. My problem is that the image, the mirror, it's dirty and it's broken. And so when the world looks at me, even if they can see God, it's distorted. It's not a true reflection. I'm called to reflect His love and His compassion. And so often I act so self-servingly. And when I do that, healthy shame comes along and says, you know what? You were made for more. You have a higher purpose. You're better than this. And I understand that that is a hard word because we have come up in a culture saturated in positive psychology. Nothing negative. Shame is always bad. We don't want to have any negativity in our lives. And so we begin to wonder whether a feeling that feels so bad can actually bring any good to our lives. Can I suggest this morning that unless we're willing to pass through and live with a little bit of healthy shame, we won't make it very far in the spiritual journey. Because healthy shame is just a part of the front end of it. Francois Fenelon describes the beginning of the spiritual journey this way. He says, as the light increases, we see ourselves to be worse than what we thought. We're amazed at our former blindness as we see issuing forth from the depths of our heart a whole swarm of shameful things like filthy reptiles crawling from a hidden cave. We could never have believed that we had harbored such things, and we stand aghast as we watch them gradually appear. But we must neither be amazed nor disheartened. We're not worse than what we were. On the contrary, we are better. But while our faults diminish, the light by which we see them waxes brighter, and we're filled with horror. Bear in mind, for your comfort, that we only perceive the sickness when the cure begins. So long as there's no sign of a cure, we're unconscious of the depths of our disease. We're in a state of blind presumption and hardness, the prey of self-delusion. While we go with the stream, we're unconscious of its rapid course, but when we begin to stem it, ever so slightly, it makes itself felt. See, what happens when we go about the business of cleaning up the mirror, the light increases and we see more and more that we were never able to see before. You see, a sense of healthy shame, I think, is the price we pay for getting close to God, because God is light. And the minute we get close to Him, we begin to see ourselves more clearly. And this is, I think, the witness of Scripture and all those saints who have drawn near to Him. This is the end of the book of Job. If you don't know the story, Job loses everything. He loses his children, his cattle, his crops, everything he has he loses. And then the rest of the book of Job is primarily dialogue between Job and his friends. And they're like, Job, whatever happened, you had to have sinned. And Job's like, I didn't sin. I haven't done anything wrong. And Job begins to call out to God and demand that God show his justice. God, why is it this way? I've done everything righteous. I've tithed and I've given to the poor and I raised my kids right and I've always worshiped you and I've always tried to avoid sin. And when I have sinned, I've apologized and I've made it right. Why do you let the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer? It doesn't make any sense, God. If you're just, you need to come down and defend yourself because I've not done anything wrong. Oh, and come down, God does. And understand, Job is a righteous man, but this is the end of it in Job 42. Listen to the way his heart has changed. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself, and I repent in dust and ash. That's a righteous man. But he's gotten a lot closer to God. It's not just that he sees God, but now he sees himself. This is the prophet Isaiah, chapter 6 of Isaiah. He has a vision. He said, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple, and the seraphim flew around. Holy, holy are you. And I fell down. I said, woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips. And I'm from a people of unclean lips. And I'm undone. Really, Isaiah? You're a prophet. You speak for God. If anybody's got clean lips, it's you. As you draw near to God, you will begin to see things in yourself you never saw before. You see, this is my problem with Jesus, by the way. I know, you're like, Pastor, you can't have a problem with Jesus. Relax. You know what, Jesus, he's not just the fullness of God. He's the fullness of man. And so when I look at him, I see everything God made all of us to be. If anybody was ever the perfect mirror, it was him. And so when I look to Jesus and I'm listening and I'm paying attention, I realize that there's a me I'm not measuring up to, because I realize I don't love the way he loves and I don't forgive the way he forgives and I certainly don't serve the way he serves. You don't believe me? Just ask Peter. He saw it. On the night Jesus was betrayed, they sat around a table. Jesus broke bread. He gave it to him. This is my body. Took the cup. This is my blood of the new covenant. He passed it around. And then he says, one of you will betray me. And later in the conversation, Peter's like, Lord, I'm ready to die for you. Would you? Really? Because in fact, tonight, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows. No, Lord, not I, not I. Mm-hmm, you, Peter. And so they go out to the garden. Peter falls asleep, of course. Jesus is arrested. Peter follows at a distance to the place that they take him. And then Peter's warming himself by the fire. And as he stands there, people begin to recognize him. You were with him, weren't you? No, not me. No. Yeah, you're one of his disciples. We saw you with him. No, I swear, I don't know what you're talking about. Luke chapter 22, verse 60. Certainly this man was also with him, for he too is a Galilean. But Peter said, man, I do not know what you're talking about. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And then Peter remembered the saying, before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times. And he went out and he wept bitterly. I can only begin to imagine what was exchanged in that glance. Probably not what we would guess. I don't think it was disappointment. Jesus can't be disappointed. He predicted it. I don't think it was anger. I think what Peter saw when he looked into the eyes of Christ was a real evaluation of himself. You see, shame is not just the sense that we've been exposed to others, but shame is experienced as an exposure to ourselves. All of a sudden, Peter realizes, I said I would die with him, but now I see the sort of man I really am. If there was ever an experience of shame, that's it. That's it. That's what happens when we get close to God. It's healthy shame, though. It's not comfortable. Y'all won't like it. But it is healthy. Because it's always an upward call. It's always an upward call, and it always comes with an offer of grace, but it's always a call to be our better self and to be what God made us to be. The realization that we're not there yet might hurt. But until you make the realization, you don't make a lot of progress. So in the end, it is good for you. But understand that unhealthy shame, toxic shame, it is not this way. The problem is it feels the same. It's the situation where your feelings aren't enough to tell you whether it's healthy or unhealthy. You have to listen to what the voice behind it is saying. It's still a measure of oneself, or to say it differently, it's still the feeling that I don't measure up. But when you wander off into unhealthy, toxic shame, what we've done is we've swapped rulers. See, healthy shame, we're measuring ourselves against who God made us to be, and we're finding that we haven't quite measured up yet. But unhealthy shame is different. Smeads describes it this way. He said, this sort of shame can be like a signal from a drunken signalman who warns of a train that is not coming. The pain of the shame is not a signal of something wrong in us that needs to be right. Our shame is what is wrong. It's a false shame because the feeling has no basis in reality. It's a shame we do not deserve because we're not as bad as our feelings tell us we are. Undeserved shame is a good gift that's gone bad. Toxic shame always comes from outside of us. It's a false voice from our false self. And our false self is a composite, it's a construct, it's something we put together with all of the expectations that are given to us from all the people around us. It comes from all over the place, but three sources stand out pretty prominently. One source is secular culture. It's about their values and what they say a meaningful life consists of. And so if you're going to be a person of value and of worth and have a good sort of life, well, then you had better be thin, muscular, attractive, sexy. You need to be very successful, and that success needs to translate into wealth, and wealth translates into importance. You need to be a somebody. You need to be significant. People should want more of your time, not less. And there's ways you can measure this. You need to have a nice new big house and a car and a boat, and there's a whole list of things that you need to demonstrate that you are this sort of person. Some of these expectations we got at a much younger age. Another source of unhealthy shame is from unaccepting parents. So if you had parents that always saw the B in the midst of all the A's, or if your parents said, you know, I really wish you were as smart as your sister, or I wish you were as well behaved as your brother. Parents who left us with the sense that our behavior was never quite making the mark, that our best was never quite good enough. We didn't measure up. And we take that and we bury it down deep, but we carry it around with us, this overwhelming sense that if I wasn't good enough for my parents, how in the world could I be good enough for anybody else? When that's our primary source of shame, we go through the rest of our lives trying to prove them wrong. Third source of shame, it's graceless religion. If you grew up in a faith community that didn't create a lot of space for the healing of the brokenness that we all have, it's the sort of community that adds rule upon rule, the place where you're worried to say what's in your head or in your heart because you've been left with the impression that holy people don't feel that way and righteous people don't think those thoughts. And I don't want anybody getting any ideas about me, so I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. The sort of places that leave you with the sense that sex and sexuality is inherently shameful. I mean, God thought it up, but there must be something wrong with it because we don't talk about that around here. If a young man likes pretty girls too much, he's probably on the fast track to hell. And if you don't kiss dating goodbye, there's probably no hope for your salvation. Yeah, I got that book. My wife is laughing more than the rest of you. So we take all these voices and we build this composite of the self that we think we're supposed to be for everybody else around us. And the truth is, it's an impossible standard, and it's a false standard because we didn't get it from God. And then every time we fail to live up to that, we experience the overwhelming wash of shame. So for me, I've got to be the perfect pastor. I've got to have a great message every Sunday. You can't preach a stinker. And I have to be good at every dimension of ministry. And there's a lot of them. I'm supposed to be a great preacher and a great theologian and a great counselor and a great leader. And I should be able to do all of these things equally well. But I'm never too busy because I always have time for everybody's problems in the whole church and time for my family. And to be a perfect preacher, you also have to be the perfect husband and the perfect father. And because I'm the perfect father, my kids are never noisy in the front row. Hope I didn't disappoint you guys. For men, it's really not too complicated. It doesn't really matter what field you're in. There's really only one standard. I mean, at the root of it all that we have to uphold, you better not appear weak. You had better, don't do it. Doesn't matter whether you're a farmer, plumber, teacher, you are a man first and foremost. You do not look weak. Don't be a sissy, man up. Don't be weak. I think it's worse for women. Because they've got more expectations heaped on them, especially mothers. There's not a lot of stay-at-home moms anymore. So you have to be the perfect mother, which means you have to always have your house perfectly clean and your kids always have to be happy and well-behaved and you have to have great meals ready on time all the time and you better look fabulous while you do it. Don't have any hairs out of place. You got to have them all there. But then also we're career women today. We're both moms and we work in the workplace. And so you have to have all of this in balance. You have to have the perfect home and be the perfect mom. And be great at work, and be successful in your career, and be the perfect wife who always has her husband happy. Look, this is impossible. We can't live up to these things. And every time we fail, shame washes over us. And understand, unhealthy shame, that is a voice from the false self. It says different things. This is how we know. This is how we differentiate. Because healthy shame says to us, you know what? You're better than this. And you were made for more. But unhealthy shame, toxic shame, says, you know what? You're a failure. And you'll never be better than this. Toxic shame. It always exaggerates our faults. It takes little failures and blows them up so big that it's difficult to see anything else in our lives. If you've ever experienced being consumed with something you did wrong, it's probably toxic shame. It always exaggerates our fault far beyond the reality. Things that most people either wouldn't even notice, and if they did, they wouldn't even care, become so large it's almost debilitating. Toxic shame, if you wrestle with this, tends to be chronic. All of us deal with shame at some point in our life, but toxic shame, it has a way of taking root, taking hold, and it just lives in us, and it comes back again and again and again. And for some of us, it becomes a primary way of thinking. Problem with toxic shame is that it's never contained. It always spills over, bleeds everywhere in our life. Healthy shame is always very focused. It's, I did this thing wrong, and this is the part of my heart that needs to be changed so I can be the person I'm meant to be. But that's not how toxic shame works. Toxic shame begins when I feel like a failure at work. Something went wrong, or I made a mistake, and I begin to hear the voice in my head, you're never going to be good enough. You're really lousy at your job. You couldn't get another job if you wanted to, so don't mess this one up. You're just really no good. And I take that, and instead of leaving it at work, I bring it home. And I feel like I'm no good as a husband, and I'm no good as a father. And so then when my wife says, you know, why didn't you take out the trash this morning? I lose it. I'm tired of you telling me that I'm a failure and always criticizing me. And she's like, whoa, I was just asking about the trash. But it spreads into every dimension and area of our life. It's never contained because it's not honest. It's never spiritual. It's never spiritual. Maybe you got it from a graceless church, but it didn't come from God, and God can't use it. It only ever gets in His way. Because it's a false evaluation of your worth and your significance. Hope you're beginning to see why it really, really matters. That we grow up emotionally and we begin to learn the difference between the two voices. The feeling always feels the same. It's always the sense that I've not measured up. But one of the voices is coming from our true self and one of them is coming from our false self, and it makes all the difference in the world that we can tell the difference. But here's the good news, at least about healthy shame. Healthy shame arises in us when we see the difference between who we actually are and who we were meant to be. It's that moment of discovery when we realize the mirror is dirty and cracked and broken, and it wasn't meant to be that way. But you know what the good news about the cross is? It's the solution for the problem of original sin. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is the answer. You may have a cracked and dirty mirror, but there's a way to get it cleaned up. And beyond just the fact that there is a solution, it's not all on you. Even healthy shame can feel really, really heavy because I know that the gap between who I am and who I'm supposed to be, it's a pretty big gap. And when I look at traversing and I say, God, I can't do that. And Jesus says, I know you can't, but I can. I can heal the things in you that are broken that you can't heal. And I can clean up the mess in you that you can't clean up. My grace is sufficient for you. That's the good news of the cross. That we can actually become the person we were meant to be. There's all sorts of different language for talking about this. John Wesley's language was that of holiness. When John Wesley talked about holiness, he meant moving from here to here. And he was very clear that it's never something we accomplish by our own effort. It is always a work of grace done by God in the human heart. Oh, but when it's done, it's a beautiful and wonderful thing. The difficulty with healthy and unhealthy shame is that so often they're talking at you at the same time. And it can be very difficult to discern the voices. Sometimes I do things as a father I'm not proud of. I come home from work, I'm tired, my son is 3. And I respond as a tired adult responds to a talkative 3-year-old. And it's not always full of grace and patience. And when I realize what I've done, all of a sudden the voices of shame start talking. One of the voices is healthy. It says, you know what, you're better than this, and you know that. You know you were called to be more. You know you're a better dad than this. You're supposed to be. And there's grace for that. And at the same time, there's that other voice. And it says, you're a lousy dad. And you're never going to be any better than what you are. And I have to learn to discern the voices, because depending on which one I listen to, it will change the course of action. If I listen to the healthy shame that says, you know what, you can be better, what am I likely to do? I'm probably going to go to my son and say, you know what, I'm sorry. That's not who I want to be. I shouldn't have snapped at you that way. You didn't do anything wrong. That was me. I'm sorry. Can we try again? But if I listen to the other voice, if I listen to the unhealthy shame, I'm more likely to withdraw. I ignore my son. In fact, I probably avoid him, because if I've hurt him once, I'll probably hurt him again. I know I'm never going to do any better, so I withdraw. I leave him hurt, and I stay hurt. There's no healing. There's no growth. We have to learn to hear the voices, discern which one is correct, and then lean into the grace of Christ. Say, God, I don't have what it takes to be better, but you do. And that is exactly what I need. And when we go to God, open hands and say, you know what, I'm not the person I need to be, we know He gives us grace. He's always faithful to work the change and transformation in our heart that we will open ourselves to. If we will but humble ourselves and ask.